zip. That's it. I tapped to one of the guys I was talking to here in Brooklyn. They just cut the antennas down. But other than that, I don't think you have much to worry about. Okay, shall I look for another one, Dick?
Fire away.
All right. I'm looking here. I'm trying to read ones that I can read on here. Mel, you once said you helped out somebody that was on an age and was having a little problem with his hearing aid. And you told him about a simple way to modify his headphones, actually to tune his headphones, and it helped him quite a bit. Let me think about this one. Oh, I think I remember this one. I'm not sure, but I think this comes to mind. In fact, the reason it comes to mind, a dear friend just passed away recently. That was K4PT, formerly W2OCL here in Brooklyn Head. He was 99 years old, and knew me since I was a youngster, since I was 13 years old, one of the first hands I ever met. And I think that's why this reminds me of this situation, that how I sort of gave him an idea of how you can tailor up the, I guess you could call it the response of your headphone, to make it a little easier, especially for you to copy CW, Dick, over.
Yeah, I'm guessing that when a person loses his hearing, he doesn't lose the whole spectrum at once. Every one of us that are beyond 25 years of age, we start losing our 15 KC response. When I was 20 years old and repairing television sets, I could walk into a person's house, and as they walked through the front door, I could tell them how many televisions were turned on and what rooms they were in, because I was hearing the 15.7 kilohertz horizontal oscillator of the TV set. Well, as soon as I hit 30 years of age, that disappeared. I now probably only go to 8 kilohertz. So I've lost the high end, and a lot of people do. Almost everyone does. Talk to somebody who's worked on the flight line at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base or Eglin Air Force Base or Edwards Air Force Base. I've spent some time on all three of those places. And the jet engine noises have very specific notes that damage their hearing. And so when you do a swept sensitivity test of the man's hearing, you'll see some very specific frequencies of suck out. And a good hearing analyst will look at that and say, ha ha, I know where you work. I know what you do as an occupation. Okay? I am guessing that your buddy W2OCL or K4 Papa Tango probably still has medium good hearing at some particular frequency. And if you could emphasize his particular earphone for that frequency, he'd still be able to copy Morse code. Pure guess on my part. I wonder if that's even close, Mel. Go ahead.
Roger. Yeah, Ed, I just say, was 99, just passed away. And, we became very good friends when he was living here in Brooklyn some years ago. He retired, went down to Florida. And I used to get together with him on 20 meters in the morning, Mobile. And before he went, he was playing golf, getting around pretty good. In fact, only it was in about a year or so ago, he told me he went up his power. I said, oh, for God's sake. He says, yeah, I want to tighten up, make sure the rotor bolts that bolted into the power were tight. I says, oh, boy. I said, you couldn't get somebody to do it, but hey, that's the way he was. Quite a person. Had a lot of friends in ham radio, too. He ran the intercon net on 20 meters for many years. And so he met a lot of people, traveled around a lot, went visiting a lot of people, too. What I did, I think, that's, I'm trying to recall what I did. That's why I'm just basically chatting away here. Yes, I remember what I basically, how I arranged it for him. This most likely will help a lot of people by making a little, very simple gadget up. Again, very simple thing to add that will make it easier for maybe you to understand. As Dick says, I know I used to listen to, I tell you right away, of a horizontal oscillator on TV set with all frequencies. I mean, that's how, you know, you get tuned to that. But as you age, the high frequency loss becomes considerable. So I'm just recalling, making a little notes here of how I went about it. Just give me a second. Okay. What I did, first of all, let's talk about the headphones. The headphones that I use, in fact, for copying CW, to me, I have one of the best, I think, pair of headphones for CW copying. They were made during World War II. Actually, it was my father's phone. And they were called the SignalCore Type R14 headphones. They were made by a company called Murdoch, M-U-R-D-O-C-K. Now, these phones were considered, I believe what you would say, medium and peak type phones. They categorized the headphones. Let's give the category first for headphones. If you take an ohm meter and measure your headphones, and the DC resistance is 1,000 ohms or more, I believe that is classified as high impedance phone. Would you know that, Dick, over?
That sounds about right to me. And if you put a 1KC note through there because of a little bit of inductance, you'll measure slightly higher than 1,000 ohms. But that ohm meter test is a good way of knowing pretty fast. Go ahead.
Okay, so if we go with any of the phones that will give you, say, 1,000 ohms, if it's a little under, I'd say somewhere between, say, 500 and, say, 800 ohms, I guess we did that medium and peak. If the phone, now there are a lot of these bargain phones I know around that they were selling that you may measure under 100 ohms on a VC. Very low, you know, resistance under 100 ohms. Basically, I think they were made by, they actually had little 8 ohm speakers or something inside the headphones. They would be too low to do very much with Dick. I think you may have seen that, over.
I once picked up a set of headphones that measured 16 ohms, Mel, and I think they really contained a pair of 8 ohm loudspeakers in series. And in a case like that, you've got to be a little bit careful. I think defending yourself against that, I believe the quarter-inch diameter phone jack on the front end of most hi-fis has got something like a 1,000-ohm or a 600-ohm resistor in series with the actual amplifier. If that resistor wasn't there, and you tried to blast 100 watts that comes out of one of those amplifiers into a 16-ohm loudspeaker, I'm relatively sure you could deafen yourself. Now back to you, Mel.
I think those phones, a lot of them had like 8 ohm or 16 ohm, if you measure them. I think those sticks were meant to connect right across the speaker output, am I correct, over?
Yeah, but I'm worried about that. Since the hi-fi amplifier is made to deliver lots of power into 8 or 16 ohm, and you only want milliwatt of power into your headset, you put more than a milliwatt of real audio power into your hearing system, and you can easily do damage to your hearing. So a 16-ohm set of earphones, if they are miswired and directly put across the loudspeaker, I think you can get yourself in quite a bit of trouble. Back to you, Mel.
And I think they're marketing them. In fact, I think I have a pair downstairs. They're pretty heavy. A number of years ago, they're fairly heavy phones. And I think they were rated to put like 40 watts in, you know. Let me tell you something. I ride many times. I have the windows closed in the car. And the car right beside me has got the windows closed, and my car is shaking. So you talk about volume levels. Well, anyway, let's get back to what I did here. I more or less sketched it out. You take the headphone, and you cut one lead of the headphone, you can make it up yourself, up the jack, however you want to make it. You can make up this little device. In fact, you can make up a little box and then put this device in. And so what you're going to do, you're going to get yourself an 88 millihenry toroid. I see a lot of them, they sell them, see them in handsets and all. They were used in the telephone industry extensively. Some of the first time I ever saw a toroidal was basically the potted toroidals that were used in telephone systems, called 88 millihenry toroids. And what you'll do, you'll put the toroid in series with one lead of the headphone, and also, in theory, you'll put a capacitor. Now, what you do now, if you have a capacitor decade box, that's excellent. That'll go, say, from, say, 0.01, let's say from a 005 to 0.1. You can, by turning this and listening to, like, W1AW or something, just as so when it's comfortable for your hearing, Dick, over.
Okay, I think I see where you're going, and I'm doing a calculation right now as to how many ohms of reactance 88 millihenry is at 1 kilohertz. Back to you, Mel.
Roger. So I remember doing that. Basically, it was an outgrowth of adopting an RTTY filter system. The copy RTTY, they had a number of different filter circuits that you could add on to the input of the TU. And they were all based on using either 88 or 44 millihenry toroid stick over.
And 88 millihenry at 1 kilohertz is a inductor reactance of 553 ohms. So now, that's the beginning of a resonator. Choose the right capacitor, and you can emphasize almost any particular frequency region you want to with that. Go ahead.
Roger, roger. And I think, like, for instance, frequency response, when you tailor it, you know, when you sit there, because, you know, you can't tell somebody, you know, what will be right for them. I guess that's why they give people hearing tests. I'm sure that a hearing aid most likely has little compensating networks in there that are similar to this. So by taking up a little box, and then once you've got the capacitor, the right capacitor, of course, then you can put a fixed capacitor in, and you can make your headphones just plug into this little mini box, and that plugs back into your receiver. I think that should be a simple enough way of doing it, Dick. Over.
That's one approach. Another approach is to buy one of these hi-fi shaper networks, or what I call them, pre-distorter, shaper. It's called a Baxandall circuit. Mr. Baxandall, B-A-X-A-N-D-A-L, I think invented the thing. It'll give you treble boost or treble cut, bass boost or bass cut, and the more elaborate ones, it's got about 5 or 10 slide switches, and each of the slide switches will emphasize a particular portion of the audio frequency region between, let's say, 60 hertz and 16 kilohertz. So if you take your person who has who's a little bit hard of hearing, and you have him use one of these hi-fi shaper networks with a preamplifier between his source of his ham radio rig through the shaper network into an amplifier, audio amplifier, into his headphones, and let him move the slide switches up and down, you may discover that when it comes to listening to single sideband speech, if you emphasize the middle and depress the lows a little bit and emphasize the highs even more, he may be able to get some pretty clean single sideband speech. That would be one set of settings. And maybe there's another better set of settings when he's listening to Morse code. There are some guys who love to listen to Morse code at 1.5 kilohertz, very high pitch. I, when it comes to a weak signal of noise, I get the best sensitivity when I move it all the way down to about a 600 hertz or a 400 hertz note. That's me. Each person is different as to what his ideal frequency is for listening to a weak CW signal in the noise. And as my hearing gets older, I probably will shift a little bit as to what frequency I like to listen to. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Roger. Yeah, that's what I like to listen to. For some reason, I like it sharp. I feel I can go faster with it. Okay. Just say try, like Dick said. Yeah, get those equalizers, gadgets like that, but if you want something, you know, real compact, try the method I just said. It's very cheap. Maybe that's why it's good to be popular, and it's very simple to make up as a nice little project, nice little compact project to make up, and it just may fit your situation like it did for my friend Ed. Okay, shall we try another one, Dick?
Go for another goodie.
Okay, I'm reading, and I'm reading. right? What does this person have to say? Oh, okay. Very interesting. He says, I have an older receiver. You most likely remember it as the Super Pro 600. Oh, yes, well, I remember the Super Pro 600. I noticed something. How come a lot of times on the Super Pro 600, the S meter reads higher than well, some of my newer equipment? How come I get a higher S unit reading? Does it mean that this receiver, back in those days, was a better receiver? That's a whole story in itself, Dick. Go ahead.
Yeah, signal strength meters, RSSI, receiver signal strength indicator, is a terminal coming out of many of these almost complete receiver on a chip. It's called the RSSI terminal, which usually goes to some kind of a metering circuit. Every one of our ham radio receivers has got an S meter. Almost every single one of our ham radio receivers has an S meter with really poor calibration. Of all the things that we rate, you go down the rating list in QST magazine for any new piece of hardware. They tell you how many watts it puts out on each of the bands, how much intermodulation distortion when it's running in the sideband mode, how strong are the harmonics, how weak is the receiver sensitivity. They give you a whole lot of measurements. Blocking dynamic range, strong signal tolerance, out of band, strong signal tolerance, and whatever. They give you lots and lots of data. The one piece of data that's usually not there, or if it's there, it's not emphasized, is accuracy of the S-meter. The original definition of an S-meter is that an S9 signal is 50 microvolts presented to the back panel of your receiver. 50 microvolts is S9. Each S unit is supposed to be 6 decibels different, which is a 2-to-1 voltage ratio. So if the receiver S meter was perfectly calibrated, S9 would be 50 microvolts, S8 would be 25 microvolts, S7 would be 12.5 microvolts, and so on all the way down. S9 plus 20 dB would be 10 times the voltage. It would be 100 microvolts. S9 plus 40 dB would be 10 times again. Let's see now if I got that right. Plus 20 would be 500. I got it. Here we go. 6 dB above would be 100 microvolts. S9 plus 20 dB would be 500 microvolts. S9 plus 40 dB would be 5,000 microvolts. The reason I went up in 20 dB steps, and I know that 20 dB is a 10-to-1 voltage ratio. So that's a perfectly calibrated S meter. On one occasion, I brought home a signal strength, a calibrated signal generator, traceable to the bureau in current calibration from the coal mine I was working for at the time, and I checked out my Drake 2B, my Drake R4C, my Icon 7000. I checked a whole lot of receivers. Wow. Instead of 6 dB per S unit, down at the low end of the scale, I sometimes found 2 dB per S unit instead of 6. Sometimes at the high end of the scale, I found, I got it backwards. A very small number of dB with the S units down at the low end. A very large number of dB with the S units at the high end. There was a potentiometer in most of the receivers where you could set the sensitivity of the S meter. The closest thing I ever got to a calibrated range is on the Drake R4C receiver when I set the sensitivity in the offset knob just right. I could make the S meter read 5 decibels for each one of the S units. It's supposed to be 6, but at least I got linear calibration at 5, and I knew where I was. Most of the other receivers, I couldn't even come close. So when it comes to signal strength indicated on your meter, that's a tough one. If the guy you're talking to in Africa tells you you're running S9, and the guy you talk to in England tells you you're running S9 plus 10 dB, does that really mean you're 10 decibels stronger in England? I doubt it. It's a very rough indicator. It tells you something. But if you think those readings are traceable to the bureau, there's a bridge very close to Mel's house, and he can see out his window. I could tell you a piece of it. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Ditto. If anything, if we have something that would be continuing for so many years, it's the RST system. It's a farce, really. That's what I always say, the RST system. Don't worry. As long as they understand you on the other end, don't worry so much about, God's sake, whether, you know, they give you an S7, 8, or 9. As Dick was saying, basically what has happened over the years, the S unit standard started around, around World War II. They started the system. Now, so basically the S meters went on the receiver so that if you wanted to do an A-B test with your antenna and you're talking to somebody and say, well, I'll try antenna A and then antenna B, he could watch the meter and give you an idea, say, antenna A instead of B or vice versa, whatever the story is. But after a while, the hams got so dependent on the S meter reading and they sort of sell the radios, especially. You bought Model A last year, that receiver last year, and as well, this is something that Model B this year, and you put them side by side, the S meter read higher on the new receiver. Oh, this must be a better receiver because the S meter is reading higher. All they did is trick the circuit so that the S meter amplifier was more responsive. But as Dick said, if you made some measurements, you start making measurements, which I did, and you see that, oh boy, it is way off. In fact, if you found one band that the S meter was close, was pretty good. Most of the time, the S meter wasn't even close on any of the bands. So it really was that they originally had the idea that a change of 60 dB was S9 when referenced to 50 microvolts RMS into a 50 ohm system. So if you said then, well, you're down to S1, it actually was to be mean that you were 48 dB below 50 microvolts. In other words, that's what the original calibration was, but boy, did they abuse that, Dick, over.
Now, this whole episode of mine of bringing home my calibrated signal generator and rating all my receivers gave me a lot of fun and gave me quite a bit of trouble. I realized that S meters were really crazy. I made a calibration chart for each one of my receivers, and I rated it in microvolts. And so then I started talking to guys on 432, and I would say, today, you're giving me 41.5 microvolts. And everybody wanted to talk to me. They wanted to find out how many microvolts they were running. And then they would compare the microvolts on a rainy day versus a dry day, winter versus summer, and so on. What we discovered is that a guy who's 432 megacycle antenna cleared the local trees. He was roughly the same signal strength, summer, winter, spring, and fall. The guy whose antenna was below tree level, he would be 10, 15, 20 dB weaker in the summertime when it rained and there was water on the leaves. His signal would fall off by 20 dB. Because I had an exact number of microvolts on that receiver, it was a calibration technique that was almost traceable to the bureau. And of the 450 different guys I talked to on the 432 band between 1972, when I came up with the parallel kilowatt amplifier, and roughly 1985, in that 13-year period of time, I talked to 450 guys. I have a card file for each one of those, a 3x5 card for each one of those guys, and the date I talked to them, what they were using, and how many microvolts. You'd be amazed how many guys come back to me 6 months, a year and a half later, saying, gee, Dick, I used to run a 13-element Yagi. I've gone over to a pair of 16-element Yagis. How many microvolts am I reading now? And most of the time, they're happy. Once in a blue moon, they would be very unhappy, and they went and found out, oh, I got a vertical stacking of the two antennas, but I got them out of phase with each other. I got a null on the horizon. And they found it out by that kind of jazz. So I was a very busy fella. Had a lot of people to talk to, and everybody wanted to know how many microvolts they were that day. So microvolts was something to me that was traceable to the bureau. The S units, S6, doesn't mean anything. That's how I got around it, and it created a lot of work for me, but I think I was enjoying it. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Basically, I did the same thing with the Collins 7584 receiver, and I determined exactly how many dBm was each reading from up to S9. And I've got a whole chart here. I remember that S9, I think I was calibrated. That's pretty good, the Collins 7584, because Collins didn't worry about, he didn't have to worry about that brand B was going to be sitting next to a Collins 7584 receiver, and that S meter was going to read much higher. That was not the criteria for Collins. It was the quality and the accuracy of the product. And I remember that I measured the voltage level on the Collins receiver, S9 as minus 73 dBm. And I know I made a chart for that, so my minus 73 dBm came very close to being 50 microvolts, and I just went down the line like that, down to S1 thick over.
It's a good approach. And that way you could give a guy a meaningful signal strength report when he talks to KE2KEY or K2LAW. So you and I are two of the very rare guys who are giving out meaningful signal strength reports. So we got something else in common. I never knew you were doing that also, Mel.
Oh, that's the engineering, you know, can't help it. You know, when you do precise engineering, I guess that carries over even to your hobby. But I'll tell you one thing, Dick. You want to guarantee yourself a DX card from a place. You want to guarantee it, you better write 599 on it, over.
Oh, yeah. You tell the guy the truth, and he was an S3 signal, and everyone else was giving him 599. He thinks something's wrong with your equipment, and he might not send you a card, even if you send him a green stamp.
Oh, yeah. That's it. That was the psychology. If you listen to all this nonsense, especially they got a contact. Everything is, number three, number four, 599. Why do we even put this stuff in? What do we need this RFP reporting system? I just don't understand it. Unless, again, if somebody says, well, I'm going to do an A/B test or something, and tell me what the difference is. But what's the difference if I said your signal went from 5.5 to 5.7? That gives you a reference. But boy, oh boy, if it don't start out at 5.9, say, oh, now you're 5 or 10 over, you don't know what you're doing, Dick. Don't do it on 75. You'll have a crowd on it after you're over.
Then the next problem I had, Mel, recently I was on 2 meters, and I was trying to find out how strong a particular signal was. And I had a precision step attenuator made by Hewlett-Packard. That's good to 18 gigahertz. And I set it up in between my 2-meter receiver and the antenna. And I was stepping in 10 dB steps on one attenuator and 1 dB steps on the other, and I could find out exactly how many dB the guy was over the noise or over some other signal. That's the good news. The bad news is the darn thing was rated for 1 watt maximum. And I left it into the 20 dB setting one day, and I transmitted through it, and the rig puts out 30 watts. Wiped out a beautiful step attenuator. And then getting it repaired, that's another whole story. You take these precision Hewlett-Packard step attenuators that are rated for 18 gigs, and you try to buy the spare, you try to buy the replaceable component inside, that is the thing that I burned up. They will not sell it to you. They want that to be a factory repair. Well, I found out, I put out the word on the microwave reflector that I need I need the 20 dB step attenuator for a Hewlett-Packard model so-and-so. And somebody came through and handed me some of those, and I installed it. And it worked pretty well, but not exactly well. I then went and did some laboratory measurements with that, where I was doing a two-tone test on a precision piece of microwave equipment, and I suddenly realized that my modified, repaired step attenuator was making passive intermodulation distortion intermittently on the 20 dB step. In other words, there's some other magic as to how they put it in there. I must have done some damage to the little gold leaf that makes contact when you flip the knob on the front panel, and it wasn't making good enough contact, and I think that's how it was making passive intermodulation distortion. I did the repair very carefully under a good microscope, a stereo microscope, I thought I had done an excellent repair. Well, that particular step attenuator is now suspect whenever you're doing a two-tone test. K2KUY, K2LIW.
Yeah, roger, roger. Yeah. That's it. That's why they have a lot of these things that the tone attempts to repair on them. It can only be done by the factory. They won't even, you know, many complaints. Some of the, like you say, Hewlett Packard, well, they were very independent. Lucky that we were able to get service books in many cases for them, from them, but a lot of things, you know, not use the serviceable. That is what it used to be marked, a number of things. Not use the serviceable. So that was the story on them. I don't know what their current, you know, situation, the current, you know, since the company changed hand over, shake up and all, how, well, you know, how they are treating their consumers now in their commercial test equipment and all. I don't know what the, I haven't dealt with them in recent years yet. All right, should we go on, over?
Yes, we should. Yeah, Hewlett Packard, the instrumentation division, became Agilent, and Agilent hired some bean counters that tried to increase the profit of the instrumentation division to try to make it equal to the profit of the computer division, which kept the name Hewlett Packard. Bad move. They ended up scuttling all of the research and development of new products. They ended up firing a whole lot of engineers. They ended up hurting the morale, a whole lot of the company. They closed down certain divisions. What else happened that was bad? People left. People became disgruntled. The Hewlett Packard Journal is no longer being published. The new development is no longer taking place. They started outsourcing all of their equipment manuals. Now the equipment manual sometimes are nowhere near the quality they used to be, the owner's manual and the service manual. And the products themselves have gone down a little bit in quality. All of a sudden now Rohde & Schwarz is giving Hewlett Packard a lot of competition when it comes to spectrum analyzers and network analyzers. Agilent is giving them a lot of competition. So the bean counters have taken a darn good company and they turned it into a little bit more of a mediocre company. How in the world anyone with any brains allowed that to happen is beyond me. That was the Cadillac of instrumentation providers in the United States for 40 solid years, 50 years. And now they've been turned into an also-ran by the bean counters. I can't believe they've increased the profit. They should have realized that instrumentation division of a company has a very steady sales per year. And if you think by some magic you're going to suddenly double the sales and everybody's going to buy twice as many signal generators and twice as many spectrum analyzers with the same customers doing the same work, what in the world are you smoking? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Roger. Well, that's what happens. One after another, you're repeating the same thing of many a company. When the conscientious owners were there, Hewlett and Packard in one story, and this is what happens over and over again. The same, you know, thing, this is repeated over and over again. What happens to these great companies when, like you say, the bean counters come into the picture, many of them strictly with no engineering or anything background, really don't know much other than, what does it say, dollars and cents, and they figure, well, what's the difference? Nobody uses this and does this and everything. Oh, it's just very ridiculous what goes on. No use in getting into that. It makes me very upset when I see, I know a number of companies that basically went through the same thing, took terrific companies and within a few years literally destroyed a thing. Shall we go on?
Yes, we should. I'm going to give you one other example. On five occasions in the last 15 years, I walk into a company called LensCrafter, and I buy a set of glasses. And I always buy the set of glasses that have the style that's called aviator style, the very large lenses that sort of conform to your face. You watch any television program like C-SPAN, C-SPAN 2, Miami Vice, CSI Miami, CSI New York. Look at any professional people, physicians, doctors, scientists, lawyers, senators, representative, a very high percentage of those people are wearing aviator-style glasses. Arguably, it is the most popular style of glasses that men wear in the United States and quite a bit of Europe and quite a bit of Asia. Worldwide, it may very well be the most popular style of glasses on planet Earth. The geniuses in Mason, Ohio, at LensCrafter, decided to obsolete that style of glasses. They decided 6 months or a year ago to force everyone into these little bitty square things. And I'm hearing a lot of people bitching and moaning about this. And I'm going to do a little bit of testing of other brand names. I've lost brand loyalty. Up till now, I like that particular brand. They've lost me as a customer. And if I find out that the other brands are doing the same thing and that it's really a collusion of some kind, boy, am I going to be writing letters. K2KEY, K2LIW.
75, I know I got the same problem. I think that's going to come up here because I was wearing basically the same glasses as you were wearing there when we were sitting and talking. So I also like those full frame, whatever they refer to them as, type of glasses, the aviator style. But you're right. I had these other ones, the so-called monolithic sort of, I don't know what they call them. Bifocal type, I don't know, whatever the heck they call these things. And I didn't like them. I have a pair sitting here. But the aviators are my favorite ones. And I didn't realize what you just told me, so it doesn't make me feel that too good that next time around, if I need them, I'm going to have problems. All right, should we try one more with a little time we have left? Welcome to
BB2HWW.
How we recognize? Get to you in a second. Yeah, the aviator uses the big-sized glasses because a smart pilot spends a high percentage of his time scanning the sky in all possible directions. The biggest thing he has to worry about is striking another airplane while he's flying. So he wants glasses that give him full stereographic view of that sky. He wants to be able to swing his eyes left and right, up and down, and see a lot of sky without swinging his head. That's one of the reasons why aviator style is a very large set of glasses. Well, there's a hell of a lot of other people. I'm one of them. I want to be able to see everything at once, particularly when I'm out looking at my tower. I want to be able to see the bottom and the top without swinging my head. When I read a book, I want to be able to read a lot of the book without swinging my head, if you know what I mean. And yes, I'm wearing bifocal aviator style glasses, and it's not that expensive. And I'm also the guy that insists on having real glass. I don't like plastic. This idea that the plastic is lighter is crazy. In the beginning, they charged you more for the plastic. Now the plastic is popular, they charge you more for the glass. Doesn't matter. I pay the extra price because I like glass, because I wear them for 5 solid years, and I don't want to have scratches all over the darn thing. And it's a lot harder to scratch the glass than it is the plastic. But still, for them to obsolete the most popular style, my goodness, is that arrogant. I'm about to start asking the individual store managers, when you guys as individual store managers complained, what did your headquarters say back? I know they're going to look at me like a deer in the headlights. Then I'm going to ask them, do you like being treated like a lemon? That'd be B2HWW, K2LIW.
All right, Dick, am I okay now? I was going to finish up that comment.
Give it a try.
All right, Dick, what I was saying before, when you hook up the transmission line, at the top of the tower, I would go directly into the antenna.
Looks like we're not going to get it, Howie, I'm sorry to say. But yes, you could go, without a doubt. The 70-ohm transmission line goes straight into the antenna. And with a little bit of reasonable loss of the line, if it's long enough, you'll be close enough to 75 ohms at the bottom, particularly if it's a even number of quarter wavelengths of cable. You'll be very close to 70. I take it back. Nope. If it was very low in loss and you were an even number of quarter waves, you would have 50 ohms at the bottom. So to force the cable to look like 75 ohms, when you're aligning just the lower impedance matching device, because you intend to make a pair of them, making the cable look like 75 ohms is not easy without putting a 75 ohm resistor somewhere. Not easy. But we'll come back to that one. I can tell that Mel and I are going to be revisiting this one next week. Mel, you're about to read the next one. K2KEY, K2LAW.
This
match one side of it. You don't have to match both sides of it, Dick.
How do you match one side when it's not going to be 75 ohms? You put a 50 ohm load on the end of a 75 ohm cable, and if you have an odd number of wavelengths, some crazy number of wavelengths, the impedance you'll be matching at the bottom will be 81 ohms resistor with 20 ohms of reactance. That's what you'll be matching. You'll swing around that Smith chart to every one of those possible impedances with that 1.5 standing wave ratio. Unless you know the length of the cable and the impedance of your antenna at the far end, how do you know what you're matching? You will not be matching 75 ohms resistor. That's what I was saying, Howie.
Right, but just put a stub in there so it looks like it's happy.
Yes, if you intend to only match the bottom, you're absolutely right, that's the right way to go. But if you want to go one step further and be a perfect purist and have a perfect impedance matches at both ends, then you have to match into 75 ohms resistor. And that requires a little bit of extra effort. I see where you're going. The average guy is already doing something heroic when he creates a perfect impedance match on a 1.5 Viswar at the bottom of the tower, at the bottom of the transmission line. That's good enough. Just match it there. I agree with you. Mel, you got it.
That's right. You're right. And if you're going to do it on both ends, you would have to use a 75, but if you just did it with a cable and got good SWR, and you had at least a 1.2 to 1, you'd be a happy camper.
Except you got a little bit of extra loss on the cable. A perfect purist will be a little bit unhappy with that if the cable is long enough. You got it, Mel.
Okay. So, KDY. All right, we'll just try to get... Not much time left. Try to get one more in here. Let me read over here, and I got one here. Because of my circumstances, I bought a multi, or I bought the coil. Okay, bought the coil for a multi-band. I don't understand this. Multi-band. I'm trying to make this out because for some reason this doesn't make any sense. Oh, I see. I have a foreshort, and that must be what the word is. Oh boy. You know, a lot of people do some abbreviating on email that is worse than a ham time. Okay, so what he's got is a dipole, a foreshortened dipole that requires loading coil. You buy the loading coil. And it wants to know if it is the loading coil is recommended to be centrally located on the dipole element. All right. And it wants to know, is there a definite reason for this, Dick, over?
W2EL repeater system.
When you take a full half-wave dipole in free space, made out of reasonable diameter wire, that's not the, a foot in diameter, at HF frequencies, and if the dipole is truly a half-wave long, it will be 72 ohms resistive. When I say half-wave long, I mean electronically half-wave long, which is 95% of a half-wave in free space because of the capacitive end effect on the dipole, where you put the egg insulators on the end, and you put a loop of wire out there. So 95% of a half-wave will be pure 72 ohm resistive. As you make the dipole shorter, the resistive component goes down from 72 ohms and it becomes highly capacitive. As you make the dipole longer, the resistive component goes above 72 ohms and it becomes highly inductive. And there's an article explaining this if you go to the awmba.org, Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha.org, his website. At the bottom of his first page of the website, you'll see a data about impedance matching by K2RIW. There's a 1,500-word article there that explains all this. The bottom line is, make the dipole shorter and shorter. You can make the resistive component go down to 1 ohm resistive if that's what you want. Make the dipole longer, and you can make the impedance go up to 2,000 ohms resistive if you want to. What's left over when it's not a half wave electronically long is either a lot of capacitive reactance when it's short or a lot of inductive reactance when it's long. If it's short and you've got capacitive reactance, you can get rid of the capacitive reactance by putting the right magnitude of inductor in the right location. Now, the hidden question of your writer there is there a definite advantage of putting the inductor at the beginning of the dipole, right in the center, in the middle of the dipole, two-thirds of the way downrange, or at the far end? Each one of those places where you put the inductor, a different size inductor is required to get it back into resonance. There's an infinite number of solutions here. As long as you're willing to mechanically change the length of the dipole, as you electronically change the number of millihenry or microhenry of the loading coil, as you move the loading coil in various places, you can keep coming back to 72 ohms resistor or 50 ohms resistor, whichever you like. There's an infinite number of solutions. What the writer is really asking is which one of the solutions has the highest efficiency or the highest gain. And here's where there's a trap. There are various writers that in a particular case of a vertical antenna mounted on an automobile, they have discovered that the higher up the coil, the higher is the phase center. The problem with a vertical antenna mounted on an automobile, let me drop for a second, is the whole antenna system is so close to the ground that every bit of altitude you can get is going to buy you a lot. So if you can make the electronic phase center of the quarter wave radiator on your automobile higher and higher off the ground, you come out a little bit ahead. So the loading coil moved further and further out on the automobile whip will give you a little more performance. But if it's a half-wave dipole mounted horizontally in your backyard, as long as you're using low-resistance wire to wind the coil, there is absolutely positively no difference in efficiency whether the coil be in the beginning, the middle, one-third downrange, two-thirds downrange, or at the end. Choose the right combination of length, position, and amount of coil, and in every case, you'll get 98% radiation efficiency. Of the 100 watts you put into that coil, into that antenna, 98 watts will be radiating the space with essentially no change in pattern. If you look into the nitty-gritty with some of your best modeling programs, you'll find 0.2 of a dB of difference in gain with certain positions of the coil versus others. And if you think the guy on the other end running 6.5 dB of S unit on his S meter is going to see 0.2 of a dB, no way. He ain't going to see it. He ain't going to hear it. It ain't real. The difference in the ionosphere can go up 20 dB, up and down 20 dB from hour to hour during the day. And we're talking about 0.2 here. So there is no difference in efficiency. There is no difference in pattern. There is no difference in gain in where you mount the coil in the horizontal dipole. Only in the vertical dipole on a car, because you're raising the phase center, is there an apparent difference. The real radiating system of the automobile is still running 100% efficient, just that the higher phase center means a little bit less of the energy is coupled into the earth that's underneath the automobile that you're driving over. So yes, it does seem to come out a little bit ahead, but the higher the coil on the automobile. That's a bunch of strongly felt opinions. I offer anyone the opportunity to give me an opposite opinion. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Welcome to the W2EL repeater. The time is 11:47 p.m.
Okay, Roger, Dick. Well, they said that, according to the person that made the coil, the company makes the coils, this is what they recommend. And I can visualize what they are thinking, Dick, why they did that with this coil to put it in the center of the leg. And I think what they really are saying that there's good reason to put the loading coil centrally located in the dipole element is that if, good, let's put it this way, if the coil is moved near the feed point, they would figure, yes, you could most likely use less inductance, but the current in the coil would be higher, so that they think that there would be greater losses. Could that be correct, over?
If I insist on making the coil out of 18-gauge wire, you're absolutely right. But a smart guy is going to make the coil out of the same diameter wire or a little bit more than the antenna itself and the dipole itself. And if he's following that rule, I mean, if he's making the wire out of 14-gauge house wire, and he's using 14-gauge or 12-gauge to wind the coil, the loss of the coil is going to be 2%. We're spinning in the ocean here. Yeah, if I insist on making the coil out of very fine wire with carbon granules sprinkled in there, he's right. No sane amateur will make a coil that bad, in my opinion. Back to you, Mel.
No, I'm just going by how they think, because I'm looking at it as it was classically written in the book. Okay. Now, if we move the coil located towards the end of the dipole, yes, less current would flow in the coil, but more turns would be required, and that would actually increase coil loss. I'm quoting to myself basically what I've read, and this is what they use. I think it's the standards in winding coils and where to put them on dipole pick, over.
Without a doubt, it's correct. By the same token, when I pour a cup of water into the Atlantic Ocean out in front of Manhattan Beach, in theory, you and I can calculate the extra altitude of the tide. I usually call this pissing in the ocean, but you know what I mean. Without a doubt, there is a calculatable amount of rise in tide when I pour that cup of water into the ocean. If I decide, some token, when I move this coil further out, and if I'm using yucky materials, I'm going to get more efficiency. But if you've done a good job, I think the difference is extremely small. But that's an opinion. I haven't really done the test to prove it. Back to you, Mel.
I'm just quoting what I've read, in the past. I've seen this repeated over and over again so many times that, manufacturers of the coils, they sell you the coils, they sell you a kit that they'll give you the insulators, they'll give you the whole business, the wires, the whole business. Well, you buy the coils separately, and then they tell you, where to stick the coils. So how do they come up with this thinking? So this is how I believe they determined all this, how they're in their factoring in. I would assume that the ones that they sell, they sell our coils, that the loading coils that they call V-point loading coils. I would think maybe those are basically maybe the best way to go. I don't know. Maybe they're the most efficient way to go, Dick, over.
And what I'm saying, Mel, is if you use the right materials, the efficiency isn't worth talking about, the difference in efficiency. For mechanical reasons, I think it's a little bit easier to mount the coils close to the feed point. But that's just me. That's the way I'd like to do it. And that way I can inspect the coils and look at them and decide I'm going to change them because they're getting a little ratty looking or whatever. And if the coil is halfway out on the dipole, and not only do I have to climb the tower to get to the darn dipole, but I've now got to hold it in to get to the coil, to inspect it or to replace it, to me that's a pain. So I would prefer the coils in the center. I have been doing for the last couple of years, professionally speaking, a lot of experiments on UHF frequencies with antennas. And I've made a whole lot of discoveries of what is efficient and what is inefficient. And what I've discovered is the only mechanism you can have for inefficiency of an antenna on any frequency, the only inefficiency is that some of your RF energy is being turned into heat somewhere. And the main company I work with, I talked them into buying a thermal imaging camera. A few of the antennas they had been using before I arrived turned out to have numbers like 40% efficiency. You put a watt into the antenna, and only 400 milliwatts got radiated into space somewhere. And various people said, I think it's this, I think it's that. I think it's that the close components on the printed circuit board are heating up the power. I think it's the dielectric constant and loss tangent of the printed circuit board. I think it's the plastic for the outer package. I think it's the loss in the feed line. I think it's the loss in the wire of the antenna. And they went on and on and on with a zillion claims where the loss is coming from. And we went and got the thermal imaging camera, and the number of the antennas, the loss was occurring at the input connector of the antenna. It was a gold-plated connector making good gold-plated contact on the antenna element. But the problem was the gold on the antenna element was not 150 microinches thick like it should have been. It was only 40 microinches. The skin depth wasn't anywhere deep enough. The gold-plated contacts were only making a tiny little point of contact in one little spot, and you looked at it with a thermal imaging camera, and that connector blazed at you like you wouldn't believe. The second most lossy thing was the plastic, but it was way down on the list. Where the loss was coming from wasn't obvious until you made the measurement. But the bottom line of all this is you have to be turning your RF energy into heat. There's got to be a real I²R resistive loss that turned into heat somewhere. That's the only way you can eat up RF power. You either radiate it into space, you reflect it back to the transmitter, or you turn it into heat. If you measure the standing wave ratio and it's low, it ain't coming back to the transmitter. After that, it's either thermal loss or it's being radiated into space. And the thermal imaging camera shows it to you right away. What an eye-opener. K2KEY.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
K2YEW, K2RIW. Here we go. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, very good. Yeah, no, that's it. So I guess it's happiest follow, but I think the easiest way out of this is follow the manufacturer of the coil sold to you, and if there's no problem, you can't go wrong by sticking it in the middle of the leg of the dipole. And basically we try to tell you how the thinking came about, the positioning of the coil. So I'll tell you something again, don't be so doggone critical with these antennas. You take this coil, cut the wire the way they tell you, put it up the best you can, as high as you can, and clear as you can, put the connect it to your rig, and get on the air and enjoy ham radio, and let's not worry about every little nitty gritty. This is, this is a problem. They'll tell you, oh, that wire isn't cut to within, fraction of an inch on each side, and that's not this side, that gauge is twisted this way and that way. It won't work right. And the reason for that is they'd rather sell you the whole package. That's it. If you buy the coil separate for you, you're going to get a lot of disclaimers. That's why it won't work well unless you do this and this and that. And they'll say to you, I can't do this and that and that. That's why I better buy the whole kit. All right. With that, Dick, I guess we'll close it up for tonight. 73 is all. Take care. Have a great week. This is K2KEY back to K2RIW and the Tech Desk.
Very fine, Mel. I just thought of something. A number of guys are losing a lot of sleep because they're afraid their antenna has some degree of inefficiency. Many of us now are becoming more and more, it's becoming easier for us to get a thermal imaging camera. Maybe you have to use it at nighttime, not at high noon, because maybe the sky is too bright. But you put 100 watts into your antenna, key down for a few minutes, aim that thermal imaging camera, aim it on the ground, on a tripod, up at your antenna, and look to see if anything's getting hot. As I said, you might have to do it at nighttime so you have the right amount of contrast. You'll find out real fast who's getting hot, who's eating up your power. The only place where that might not work is if you've got a vertical ground plane antenna on the Earth and you don't have the right number of radials in the counterpoise. Now the amount of RF energy coupled into the ground is coupled into such a great big chunk of ground that's so good at dissipating the heat, there may not be enough delta degrees Kelvin for the thermal imaging camera to see it. That's the one case where you can have inefficiency where the camera might not show it. But if it's an antenna up in the air, you borrow somebody's thermal imaging camera, and they're becoming more and more available, you'll find out real fast, is your antenna efficient? 73, you all. This was TechNet number 1165, a series that began in September 1982, 25 and a fraction years ago. Crazy people. 73, you all, be kind to each other. Bye-bye for now. K2RIW, TechNet Limelight, we're clear.